You are listening to the SCC Cast, weekly teaching and preaching from Springview Community Church. Find us on the web at www.springviewcc.org. We are located at 12881 Andersonville Road in Davisburg, Michigan. We welcome you to come as you are to experience a friendly worship setting with biblical preaching, teaching, and application. Now, here's Pastor Ben Glupker.
To Matthew 24, verses 15 to 35, we will consider a lot of scripture this morning. It might feel a little different than some of other recent messages, but we're going to work our way through and try to understand as best we can some complex things here as we look at Jesus' words here in Matthew 24. So, begin reading in verse 15, and this is God's word, so let's listen to him together. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who's on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house, and let the one who's in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, do not go out. If they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he'll send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they'll gather his elect from the four winds and from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Father, I pray now that you'd help us. These words of yours that will not pass away, we need to understand, and we need to believe, and we need to embrace as true and good, and then respond in obedience and faith as you've called us to. Father, I pray you would use your word now in the life of your church, that you would build us up through it, that you'd strengthen us for what comes ahead. And I pray that you'd be honored in the preaching of it. Pray that you'd guide my words, guide all of our ears and hearts. And I pray the Spirit that superintended the writing of these words would open our eyes and hearts and minds to its truth and goodness, that we'd believe and obey. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I want to try to set some expectations for you as we begin, because we might come to a passage like this with different ideas and different expectations. Let me address three categories of hearers that we might have today. Perhaps you are a long-time Christian who's read these kind of things before. If you grew up as I did in the late 1970s and the 1980s and the 1990s, there was lots of talk, almost sometimes obsessive talk, about end time things, what we might call eschatology from the Greek word last, last things. That would be the era of movies like Thief in the Night, or books like the Left Behind series that started in 1995. And so there was a great deal of talk about what comes at the end. What do the end times look like? And there are many books, movies, media, teachings, lots of interest. Why so much interest at that time? Well, some of that springs from a renewed interest in what is sometimes called prophecy, what sometimes was called a rediscovery of prophecy in the 1800s and the early 1900s. At least, maybe not a rediscovery of prophecy, but a new way of thinking about it and looking at it. There began to be a very literal reading of the prophetic books and passages of the Bible. Books like the last part of Daniel, or some places in Ezekiel, or our passage in Matthew and the related ones in the Gospels, and a little bit in 1 Thessalonians, and of course especially in the book of Revelation. And they begin to read them really in kind of new ways, very literally looking for kind of what are the prophetic keys. There's a lots of, as you know if you've read these books, lots of language that's kind of complex and different than what we're used to. They don't read it all like clear histories or timelines. This will happen, then this will happen, then this will happen, the way we might expect history to be written. There's lots of language, lots of symbols, lots of different readings of all of these things. And they begin to look for kind of prophetic keys. I think I mentioned one last week, a bad example of this, the way that the early Jehovah's Witnesses begin to try to read years and days and weeks in certain specific kinds of ways. And one of the things that begin to arise, particularly in the 20th century, is the very specific sorts of timelines. This is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and then this is. And you see big charts. You can see TV pastors that have a whole big chart on the wall behind them that shows you exactly how all of these things are going to play out in the end. There were many, many debates, and the debates continue. The debates around things like the tribulation. Tribulation means suffering, and there's going to be a tribulation at the end, and is Jesus going to return at the beginning of the tribulation, pre-tribulational return, or mid-tribulational return, or post-tribulational return, and debates about things like the millennium, which talks about Jesus coming to reign in 1,000 years of peace at the end of history, and is that 1,000 years literal, or is it figurative? Is Jesus coming before the millennium? Is he coming after the millennium? Are we already in a spiritual millennium? Many different views, many different debates, all sorts of books and resources about this. That way of reading the scriptures so pervasive in churches like ours, when I was growing up at least, that we might be forgiven for thinking that that was the normal way these have been read forever since the time of the apostles. The truth is, those particular kinds of readings really started in, for the first 18 centuries of the church, didn't really exist. Those kind of readings, very specific readings, start in the middle part of the 1800s and, of course, persisted down to this day. That particular viewer approach has a lot to commend it biblically. It takes the Bible very seriously. It has a lot of strengths. It has some weaknesses as well when we look at the scriptures, and as most of these views do, the issues are challenging and they are complex. So I say all of that to say, as I try to set your expectations, as we read Matthew 24, it will not build out for us a complete end times timeline that you may perhaps prefer to see. It just doesn't give us. We would have to bring in too many other passages, way more than we could consider in one Sunday morning message. And the truth is, how we read Matthew 24, in many ways, will be driven by our bigger system and understanding of all of these things. So if you're a longtime Christian with a longtime interest in these things, that's great. I don't want to overpromise and underdeliver this morning. I will not give you a conclusive timeline as we finish this up this morning. I don't think Matthew can give us that on its own. Secondly, maybe you're here and you're more of a practical, get-to-the-point Christian. You're like, all right, it's lots of details, it's really complicated, just skip all the tricky stuff. What's the takeaway here? I mean, what's the lesson? What am I supposed to do with all of this information? It's not obvious to me what my response is supposed to be. Well, if that's your mindset, let me say, first of all, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to try to spell some of those things out. As we look at the rest of Jesus' teaching here on the Mount of Olives, the Olivet Discourse, I think in the next 3 sections, we'll see some ways that we should respond to it practically. So to you, I would say, hold on. We're going to get to those responses, but we got to build the basis of what those are coming from, and we'll try to do that this morning. There is a lesson even in our passage this morning. I mean, chapter or verse 32 tells us that. Jesus says, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. lesson, and we will try to capture the lesson in this particular section this morning before we're done. Third group that I want to address, expectations. Maybe you're just not a Christian, or you're skeptical, or you're not sure, and you read this kind of stuff, and you say, this is exactly the kind of silliness that makes Christians so weird. What is all this talk about all this stuff, sun being darkened, stars falling to the sky, all this? I mean, this is exactly the kind of weird stuff, you might be saying, that makes it hard for me to take Christianity seriously. But is it really so weird? Is it really so weird to talk about the end of the world? I think we could go back in history, looking even outside the church, and see lots of language. Let's just go back a little ways. You go back to the early 19th century, the 1800s, and you've got a lot of people following a Scottish or English philosopher named Robert Malthus with his Malthusian predictions. The earth's population is growing rapidly. Food can't keep up. There's going to be mass starvation. We are short generations away from tens of millions of people dying. There is simply no way that the world can keep up. And many, many people followed that Malthusian view. There's a population doomsday where the world is not going to be able to support. This is back when the world was like a tenth the size it is now, population. And of course, our ability to produce food is exponentially improved. But those doomsday predictions go way back. In the 20th century, when I was born, many of you will remember that most of our doomsday predictions revolved around the Cold War and nuclear holocaust, right? Massive concern. I think I've shared it about you when I was a kid. I'm not sure this is good teaching practice. You teachers and former teachers could tell me, but I remember being third grade, and my third grade teacher explained to us how the Soviets had landed in Mexico, and they were working their way up toward Texas, you know? And I remember being, oh, man, I'm glad we live in the north and not the south. It'll take them a little longer to get here, you know? But a real concern, that justified concern. And even today, nuclear holocaust is something to be concerned about. We are worried. We are worried about who has the nuclear codes. We're worried about who our geopolitical opponents, who's in charge. We're concerned about those. End of the world is on people's mind. Of course, today, the single biggest end of the world doomsday scenario that we hear about the most now is climate change. The oceans are going to rise, temperatures go up, all sorts of things are going to happen. And we hear apocalyptic talk around climate change. I don't think it's just Christians who are worried about the end of the world. Now, what's different, I think, is that for Christians, we don't look at the world and go, I don't know what's going to happen. There's no telling the way it's going to play out. Anything could happen. As Christians, we look and we say, listen, we know that terrible things have happened and will happen. Maybe even some of the things that I just mentioned will happen. But behind all of those things, using all of those things in his sovereign power and wisdom, God is steering all of those events in such a way that the story will end just the way it should. So this morning, we want to consider what that story is. We root our belief in that outcome on the person and testimony of Jesus Christ, who God raised from the dead. We take his word for it, which is what we'll do this morning. Here's where I think a lot of people find themselves, non-Christians and Christians. Do you remember the story of Hezekiah? He's a king in Israel. And we see this a few different places in the Old Testament. Isaiah 39 is one of them. And envoys from the nation of Babylon come. And they come to visit him there, and he takes them around, a powerful king showing off, and he shows all of his wealth, all of his possessions, all of his accomplishments, and then they go back on their way. And the prophet Isaiah comes to him and says, "These people from Babylon, what did you show them?" And Hezekiah says, "I showed them everything, absolutely everything. There was nothing I didn't show them." And Isaiah says to him, he says, "Listen, there's coming a day, there's going to come a day when that king of Babylon's going to come back and take everything you showed him. And he's going to take some of your own sons, some of your own descendants that come from your line. He's going to take them back and make them eunuchs to serve you in his palace." Do you remember what Hezekiah said? He picked up on that part about your sons, and he's like, "Oh, okay. Well, that's cool, because it won't happen in my day. It won't be in my day." And I think a lot of us think about these things in a similar kind of way. I'm not really sure what's going to happen. I'm not sure when it's going to happen, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to happen in my day. So I'm just not going to worry about it too much. And as we'll see this morning and over the next few weeks, that's the wrong mindset. That's the wrong approach. It may not happen in our day, but it may. And Jesus' instructions to us, as we'll see, is to be ready. Now, here's how I want to tackle this passage this morning. It is complex. If you went home and said, you know what, I want to study this for myself. I'm going to go out and find 5 books on Amazon and read what the people have to say about it. You are going to find 5 different interpretations of how the things in this passage work. It is complicated. So I am going to try to simplify, or at least try to give some framework to what we're looking at this morning. And the way I want to do that is I want to give you 6 dates. Now, don't get too excited when I say dates, but I want to give you 6 dates to try to orient ourselves to what Jesus is talking about in this passage. If you're a note taker, you can write them down. Here's the first date, 540 BC. 540 BC. Jesus begins this section in verse 15 with these words. He says, "So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand." 540 BC. Keep a marker here in Matthew 24 and turn back to the Old Testament book of Daniel. We'll be here for a little while. We consider a couple dates out of this book. Turn to the Old Testament book of Daniel. In the book of Daniel, we are backing up nearly 600 years from the time of Jesus. 540 BC, roughly 540 BC before Christ. Now, the book of Daniel divides neatly. Chapters 1 through 6 are stories, historical stories, good ones. You probably know them. Daniel refusing to eat the king's meat. Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, you know, refusing to bow to the statue. Daniel see the handwriting on the wall. Daniel in the lion's den. The last 6 chapters are very different than the first 6. In fact, look at Daniel chapter 7. Right? Daniel 6 ends with being delivered from the lion's den, prospering during the reign. But look how Daniel 7 verse 1 begins. It says, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream, visions of his head as he lay in his bed. And he wrote down the dream, and he told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, 'I saw in my vision by night, behold, the 4 winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. 4 great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then I looked as its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it.'" Here's my point. Things have changed in the book of Daniel. We've gone from stories, historical stories, to something very, very different here. What we're reading here is a kind of literature. It's no longer history. It's now apocalyptic prophecy. That word apocalypse means revelation. In fact, the Greek title of the New Testament book of Revelation is Apocalypse. It's a kind of revelation. It's full of images, full of symbols. It doesn't read like history. It reads very different. It was a common, in that part of the world at that time, really from Daniel's time till Jesus, a common literary form. And really to understand it well, we've got to understand how the genre works. It's very different than what we see here. Well, what I want to look at this morning is Daniel 9. Look in Daniel 9, verse 1. We'll see more like this. Daniel 9, verse 1. Says, "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus," now that is where we get 540, it's about that time, "by descent of Mede, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans," or Babylonians, "in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, perceived in the books the number of years that, according to the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet, must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. This is fascinating. So Daniel is there. He's in, you know, Israel has been carried away. The temple's been destroyed by the Babylonians. He's been carried to Babylon. He has, by God's grace, been given great success. He's been elevated in the kingdom. He's been an advisor to the kings. Well, here's Daniel. He's been in Babylon a long time. He's an old man. And it's fascinating. He is reading books, scrolls, of the Old Testament prophets. In this case, Jeremiah. And he's reading Jeremiah, and in his mind he's thinking, when is this exile going to end? When are we going to be delivered from our foreign captors, sent back to our homeland, rebuild our temple, rebuild the Lord's city, reestablish God's name and presence and worship the way it should be? Because they can't worship there, not like they should. There's no temple. There's no way to offer the sacrifices. And Daniel, in exile, is reading Jeremiah, which you and I can do too, because we have Jeremiah. And he discerns, it's going to be 70 years. And Daniel looks at his, pulls out his phone and looks at his calendar, and he's like, it's been almost 70 years. We're getting close. And then for the next, up through verse 20, he prays. It's beautiful. We don't have time to look at it this morning. It's a beautiful prayer that God, for the sake of his own name, would rescue his people and bring them back. And then we get to verse 20. He finishes his prayer, and it says, while I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin, the sin of my people Israel, presenting my plea before the Lord my God for the holy hill of my God, Mount Zion, where the temple should be. While I was speaking a prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. And he made me understand, speaking with me and saying, O Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out. And I've come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. Now, here's what I would like to see follow this. And I bet Daniel wanted to see it too. A very clear explanation of what's going to happen. So Daniel, week after next, and then next year in the spring and so on, it's not quite what he gets. Look at verse 24. 70 weeks are decreed about your people in your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, to anoint a most holy place. And he goes on and on about weeks. 70 weeks, literally 70 sevens, which usually the scholars have understood a seven to be, in this case, a week to be a week of years. 7 years, so 70 weeks times 7 years, 490 years is how it's typically understood. He says in verse 25, know therefore to understand from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there will be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it will be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood. To the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. He shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wings of abomination shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. Now, this might be, this almost certainly is top five most difficult passages in the Bible. Very complex. If we consider that to be 490 years, it's difficult to know exactly how that fits in with what. And there's divisions in it. There's a group of 7 years, or 7 weeks of years, and then 62 weeks of year, and then another year. Daniel's interest, Jesus' interest in this, though, is this abomination that causes desolation, which verse 26 tells us will put an end to sacrifice and offering. Which brings us to our second date, 168 BC. Daniel's going to come back to this vision of an abomination that causes desolation in chapter 11. Look at verse 1. As for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, so the same year we had the previous vision in chapter 9, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, 3 more kings shall arise in Persia. A fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he's become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. As soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides as these. Now, Daniel can't see what we have the benefit of being able to see with some historical perspective. From our historical vantage point, we can see that that history that's alluded to there tracks nicely with what we know about the next four centuries of history in the Eastern Mediterranean. Persia, the nation he is with, will prosper for a couple more generations. Eventually, there will be a great king, we assume it to be Xerxes, who will attack the Greeks. You can read about that in Herodotus, the Persian Wars. He'll attack the Greeks, and of course the Greeks will eventually fight them off. And then another great king will arise, whom we take to be Alexander the Great, and he will conquer like no other, but he doesn't. Almost as soon as he conquers, his kingdom will be broken. He dies young. He leaves, he's like 30 years old. He leaves no heirs to inherit his kingdom, so it's divided among four generals into four different kingdoms. We know all of this from history. It seems pretty clear in Daniel chapter 11 that that is what is being prophesied or predicted to Daniel here in this case. But then the next several paragraphs here get convoluted and complicated, just like the actual history does. And there's an ongoing conflict between two kings, kings from the north and kings from the south. Now, that's always the issue in Israel, because no one attacks from the west, because to the west of Israel is what? The Mediterranean Sea. They're not doing amphibious assaults in this day and age. And to the east of Israel is desert. No one's coming from there. If you're attacking Israel, you're either Egypt from the south or somebody coming from the north. And so there's conflict between kings from the north and the south. That's the part we're interested in, begins in verse 29. Chapter 11, verse 29. It says, at the time appointed, he shall return, come into the south, but it shall not be this time as it was before. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him. He shall be afraid and withdraw. He shall turn back and be enraged, take action against the holy covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the holy covenant. Forces from him shall appear, profane the temple and fortress, shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. Now, the Jewish people in Daniel's day and Jesus' day understood this to take place around 168 B.C., a king from the north named a Syrian king named Antiochus Epiphanes comes down, calling himself God. And he comes down and he comes into the temple in Jerusalem and desecrates it. He builds an altar to Zeus, his god, over the altar of burnt offering in the temple. He offers pigs on it as sacrifices, which is, of course, deeply unclean to the Jewish people. He made the practice of the Jewish religion a capital offense. The temple is, and you know well how concerned they were with ritual purity and cleanness, deeply defiled, made desolate. It is an abomination in the holy place, standing where it shouldn't be. And the level of offense is staggering. Look at verse 36. The king shall do as he wills. He'll exalt himself, magnify himself above every god, shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He'll prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. He'll pay no attention to the God of his fathers or to the one beloved by women. He shall not pay attention to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. Here's this abomination, making the temple desolate like a wilderness, desecrating it, exalting himself as God, speaking against the true gods. But what happens is the Jewish people rise up in retaliation. You see a little sense of this back in verse 32, where after it says, he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. Starting in 168 or 167 BC, a group of Jewish people led by Judas Maccabeus started a revolt, a rebellion against the Syrians, which came to be called the Maccabean Revolt. And it took a few years, but eventually they defeated the Syrians, drove them out, cleansed the temple, and reinstituted worship there. So in that day, around 168 BC, and down 200 years later to Jesus' day, Daniel's prophecy of the abomination that makes desolate was understood by the Jewish people to have taken place around 168 BC when Antiochus Epiphanes had come and desecrated the temple and defiled it. Which brings us to our third date, AD 30. A.D. A.D. is not after death. Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord, 30. That's Jesus' own day. That's when he's giving, roughly when he's giving this Olivet Discourse. He's preparing to be crucified later in this week. It's 200 years after Antiochus's abomination in the Maccabees. But just as Jesus' disciples ask about the future, he still wants to talk about the abomination that causes desolation, which they would understand to have already taken place 200 years earlier. But even in Daniel, there's a sense that the abominations aren't done with Antiochus Epiphanes in 168 BC, that there is more abominations to come. We don't have time to read them all this morning, but in Daniel chapter 12, they'll talk about a later time. Look at Daniel chapter 12. Look at verse 9. Actually, verse 8. He says, I heard, but I didn't understand. What should be the outcome? He said, and then I said, my Lord, what should be the outcome of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel. The words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall act wickedly. None of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand. And from the time the regular burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and arrives at the 1,335 days. But go your way till the end. You shall rest and stand in your allotted place at the end of the days. There is a sense here. We're not going to try to sort out what those 1,200 or 1,300 days indicate. It's hard to know for sure. But there's a sense here that there are more abominations to come. So that when Jesus talks about, watch out for this abomination that causes desolation, there is a historical reference, 168 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes, but there's also a future referent, right? More godless worship, godless rulers will try to stop the worship of the true God. There will be more godless rulers who set themselves up as God. It's going to be a feature of the last days. People that try to desecrate the true worship of God and take his place. But then Jesus goes on, back in Matthew 24, to tell them about another specific abomination that's coming, which brings us to our fourth date. A.D. 70. A.D. 70. Look back in Matthew chapter 24. You remember what started this whole message by Jesus back at the beginning of Matthew 24. The disciples are impressed with the temple. They say, look at this place. Look at the stones. Isn't this amazing? And Jesus says, I tell you, it's all coming down. Not one stone left on top of the other. And they ask, what precipitates this whole talk, well, what... or when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? That's what started all this. Well, in 66 AD, so some 36 years after this, the Jewish nation revolts against Rome, the beginning of what are called the Jewish Wars. You can read all about them in Josephus, the historian. They begin to revolt against the Romans. 4 years later, in 1870, the Romans had closed in and were besieging Jerusalem. No one could get in at that point. No one could go out. The city fell in about 5 months. The devastations were unbelievably horrible. They killed tens of thousands of people. They tear everything down. The temple, so impressive to those disciples, not one stone left on another. The whole place goes down. People scattered everywhere. The nation of Israel ceases to exist as a nation for almost 1,900 years. Israel's worship, which absolutely required the temple, the altar to sacrifice, it's gone. Can't do it anymore. Total devastation. The Romans come in. They set up their standards in the temple. They offer sacrifices to Caesar and to their gods. It is an abomination. It is a sacrilege. They make the temple set apart for the worship of the true God, they make it desolate. It seems clear that the abominations and desolations Jesus is talking about in A.D. 30 take place some 40 years later in A.D. 70. We know these events from history, which helps us make sense of chapter 24, verse 34, near the end of our reading today, where Jesus says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." In the lifetimes of many of Jesus' disciples, the horrible devastation, not one stone left on another, would occur. Now, some scholars would like to put these events, all of these events really, far into the future. And admittedly, it's difficult. Look at verse 21. Verse 21 says, "For there will be, then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and never will be." A great tribulation. Sometimes this is identified as a seven-year period at the end of history, right before the millennium, when Jesus comes back and establishes a reign of peace. Some see this great tribulation, this particular verse, talking about that time period. And in Revelation 20 does seem, which is, of course, not been written when Jesus is speaking these words, Revelation 20 does seem to indicate a great tribulation, an escalation of suffering and struggle for God's people at the end. I don't think that's what Matthew's talking about, though, here. He says in verse 21 that there will never, tribulation, there will never be, you know, never again after this, anyone greater. If he's referring to the end of the age, it would be kind of pointless and inane to say there will never be a greater suffering than this when the thing that follows it is the eternal reign of peace. There won't be any more suffering after it if that was the case. And see how he goes on in verse 22. He says, "If those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short." I don't think, it's hard to know, but I don't think those days refer to a final seven-year tribulation. I think when he says those days being cut short, he's referring to the entire period of time between Jesus' first coming and his second coming, which leads us to our next date. And here's where I'm going to hedge. The next date is AD, and we're going to have to put in a blank, because I don't know when this date is. Bible scholars don't know. You don't know. In fact, remarkably, Jesus says in verse 36 that he doesn't know. He says, "Concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only." It's interesting, isn't it? Fascinating, actually. Angels don't know. Satan doesn't know. Only the Father knows when that day is coming. Here's what I think Jesus is saying, therefore, in verse 22. When he says that if those days hadn't been cut short, I think by those days he means the entire period of time between the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70, Jesus' first coming and the second coming. I think what he's saying is, if the time, the period of time, the days between Jesus' two comings were allowed to follow their natural course, if things were allowed to get as bad as they could be, there wouldn't be anybody left. It'd be like the days of Noah. It would just be so bad. Only violence all of the time. If he let those days just follow the natural course, let's let it play out and see what happened, nobody'd be left. But God, in his merciful love for his people, will eventually cut those days short. He'll say enough is enough. In an act of grace for his people, he'll bring his people out of it, and the end will come. Well, we won't take time to go through all of verse 23 to 28. It's the same kind of things we saw last week. False messiahs will come. Don't go chasing them. He says in verse 27:8, when the Son of Man actually comes, nobody's going to be surprised, right? And he says, if someone says, "Hey, let's go out to the wilderness and see the Messiah," you can be like, "No, I don't have to go to the wilderness to find the Messiah." If someone's like, "Hey, he's hidden in this inner room," you're like, I don't need to go to an inner room. When he comes, he's going to come in the sky. There won't be any question. We'll know when he comes. His return will be unmistakable. But in verse 29, he seems to jump back to some our unspecified future date. He talks about after the tribulation of those days, and again, I think those days refers to this entire period of time between Christ's first and second coming. After that, he says, the sun will be darkened, the moon won't give light, the stars will fall from heaven, that there is coming at the end a kind of cataclysm. a kind of earth-shaking, heaven-shaking cataclysm. It could be that this imagery, sometimes it was in apocalyptic literature, just refers to kings and countries and political events. Seems awful drastic for that. It could refer to heavenly powers. Often the sun and the moon and stars in the ancient world are considered angelic, spiritual, or demonic creatures. It could be those things. But I think this is pointing us toward the end when the Son of Man finally comes on clouds of heaven with power and great glory. The trumpet sounds. He gathers his elect, his chosen people from the four corners of the world. I think here at the end, we're looking forward to that second coming, this date that we don't yet know, but that is surely coming. Let me finish this morning one more date. AD 2023. Right now. What are we supposed to do with this information today? I mean, what's the lesson here? We've covered some complex ground. I've tried to hit the high points. There are all sorts of little details that are really complicated. What's the lesson for us from this? Well, as I said earlier, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to consider three specific responses that I think flow out of the next sections in this talk by Jesus. But I want to highlight the lesson Jesus draws out beginning in verse 32. He says, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. You see how I got from lesson to lesson there, right? From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know the summer is near. Most of the trees in that part of the world, very warm climate, don't lose their leaves like they do here. The fig tree did. And when the fig tree's leaves come back, it means summer's coming and fruit isn't far away. You see the leaves and you know. Jesus says, look, when you see these things, verse 33, when you see all these things, you know that he's near at the very gates. When you see these signs, you'll know that the end is here. Well, what are these things? What are these signs? Well, really, all the things we saw from verse 4 through 28, all the troubles, all the sufferings, lots of general kind of signs. That, of course, that one very specific sign that took place in 70 AD when the temple fell and the Jewish nation ceased to exist. The kinds of trials and tribulations that will characterize the entire period between his first coming and his second. When you see these signs, know that the end is near. Verse 34, as we saw earlier, this generation won't pass away until all these things take place. Here's what I think that means. That once the temple goes down in 70 AD, everything that must happen has happened. Once that big, key, specific sign takes place, you got to be ready. Because all these other things are falling into place. The end, he says, verse 35, is near. The lesson for us today, verse 35, heaven and earth will pass away. Jesus says, my words will not pass away. Heaven and earth will pass away. He's just got done telling us that. Sun, moon, and stars are all going to fall. This whole world is going down. But Jesus says, not my words. You can bank on this. The time is near. It's not far away. It could be any time. And the outcome and the events are certain. So what we don't want to be is what we're often tempted to be, as we said earlier. Well, it's probably going to happen, not really sure, but it probably won't be in my lifetime. He says, no. That's not the attitude we must take. He's not far away, and it won't be long. Father, I pray that you'd help us. We've covered all sorts of information here. We haven't even really considered very strongly what we need to do in light of what it says. I pray you'd help us in the next couple weeks as we consider those things. I pray that we would really believe that you are coming and that it's not far away. We won't respond in these three big areas of obedience and faith that you're going to call us to. We won't even do them if we don't believe it. We'll put it off, we'll ignore it, we'll focus on other things. We need a great conviction that your words are true, that Jesus' prophetic words here are certain, that the time is near, so we need to act and respond now. Father, there may be somebody here this morning whose first response needs to be trusting in Jesus and his words. Trusting that this Jesus who is sharing these prophecies here is the one who will go to the cross in just a few days after this, who will die a death for sinners, even though he was not a sinner, and then rises again to new life so that every sinner like us who puts their faith and trust in him might live with him forever. Father, that's the hope we need. That's the certainty. That's the word we must trust and embrace. And if there's anyone here who hasn't done that, I pray this morning, right now, they would put their faith and trust in Jesus. Lord, I do pray over the next couple weeks as we consider these things. You're going to tell us how to respond, and I pray that we would. I pray you'd give us faith, strength to obey, confidence in your word, for your glory and our joy in you. I pray in Jesus' name.